Book of Daniel, please, and chapter 11, verse 35 verses. I'm reading from the Revised Authorized Version. Also, in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him. I think a lot of commentators are agreed that they feel that verse should be in the former chapter, and that it really starts chapter 11 at verse 2. And now I tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings will arise in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than them all. By his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece. Then a mighty king shall arise who shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken up and divided towards the four winds of heaven, but not among his posterity, nor according to his dominion with which he ruled. For his kingdom shall be uprooted, even for others besides these. Then the king of the south shall become strong, as well as one of his princes, and he shall gain power over him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. And at the end of some years, they shall join forces. For the daughter of the king of the south shall go to the king of the north to make an agreement. But she shall not retain the power of her authority, and neither he nor his authority shall stand. But she shall be given up with those who brought her, and with him who begot her, and with him who strengthened her in those times. But from a branch of her roots one shall arise in his place, who shall come with an army, enter the fortress of the king of the north, and deal with them and prevail. And he shall also carry their gods captive to Egypt, with their princes and their precious articles of silver and gold. And he shall continue more years than the king of the north. Then the king of the north shall come to the kingdom of the king of the south, but he shall return to his own land. However, his sons shall stir up strife and assemble a multitude of great forces. And one shall certainly come and overwhelm and pass through. Then he shall return to his fortress and stir up strife. And the king of the south shall be moved with rage and go out and fight with him, with the king of the north, who shall muster a great multitude. But the multitude shall be given into the hand of his enemy. When he was taken away, the multitude, his heart will be lifted up. Has taken away the multitude, his heart will be lifted up. And he will cast down tens of thousands, but he will not prevail. For the king of the north will return and muster a great multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come at the end of some years with a great army and much equipment. And in those times many shall rise up against the king of the south. Also certain violent men of your people shall exalt themselves in fulfillment of the vision, but they shall fall. So the king of the north shall come and build a siege mount and take a fortified city, and the forces of the south shall not withstand him. Even his choice troops shall have no strength to resist. But he who comes against him shall do according to his own will, and no one shall stand against him. He shall stand in the glorious land with destruction in his power. He shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do. And he shall give him the daughter of women to destroy it, but she shall not stand with him or before him. After this he shall turn his face to the coastlands and shall take many, but a ruler shall bring the reproach against them to an end. And with the reproach removed, he shall turn back on him. Then he shall turn his face towards the fortress of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. There shall arise in his place one who imposes taxes on the glorious kingdom, but within a few days he shall be destroyed, but not in anger or in battle. And in his place shall arise, and this is the one I'm particularly interested in, a vile person to whom they will not give the honor of royalty. But he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by, some translations have it, flatteries or intrigue. With the force of a flood, they shall be swept away from before him and be broken, and also the prince of the covenant. And after the league is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, for he shall come up and become strong with a small number of people. He shall enter peaceably, even into the richest places of the province. And he shall do what his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers. He shall disperse among them the plunder, spoil, and riches. And he shall devise his plans against the strongholds, but only for a time. He shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army. But he shall not stand, for they shall devise plans against him. Yes, those who eat the portion of his delicacies shall destroy him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. Both these kings' hearts shall be bent on evil, and they shall speak lies at the same table. But it shall not prosper, for the end will still be at the appointed time. While returning to his land with great riches, his heart shall be moved against the holy covenant. So he shall do damage and return to his own land. At the appointed time, he shall return and go toward the south, but it shall not be like the former or the latter. For the ships from western lands or western coastlands, especially Cyprus, shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved and return in rage against the holy covenant and do damage. So he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the holy covenant. And forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Then they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. And those who do wickedly against the covenant he shall corrupt with flattery. But the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. And those of the people who understand shall instruct many. Yet for many days they shall fall by sword and flame, by captivity and plundering. Now when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help. But many shall join with them by intrigue. And some of those of understanding shall fall to refine them, purge them, and make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time. Now the seaborne summit, battered by a lot of winds, has finished just off Malta on Sunday. It closed in a very spectacular manner when the two most powerful men on the face of the earth today, politically, seemed to say together that the Cold War is now over. When President Bush arrived in Brussels, I noted what he said. He said, "Tonight, we stand at the crossroads of history on the way to a Europe whole and free." Brave words. President Gorbachev, I noted, said that he had assured President Bush that the Soviet Union would never start a hot war against the United States or any other country. I wonder what that means. He promised he would never, and they would never, start a hot war against any country. Now, I would love to think that this talk of peace was going to bring about peace. But I'm afraid at the moment that in Europe, the cry and in the world is peace, peace, and there is no peace. I smiled today listening to a broadcast from a Filipino businessman in Manila who was laughing. He said that 500 rebels have got a famous hotel in the center of Manila in their hands, and they know they can't win, but they want to inflict as much damage as they possibly can on President Aquino until they are finally taken. And this businessman was laughing. He said, you know, it's called a war zone. And he said, what is so amusing is that people who work in the hotel are going into work in the morning and going home at night. And he thought that was very funny, in and out of the war zone. I didn't actually think it was funny at all, and I'm sure they didn't. But he found it amusing that there it was. People seemed to be going about their business while other fellas were shooting each other and shooting at each other, trying to make a political point. You see, peace, peace, and there is no peace. Shortly after the fall of Adam and Eve, we know very well that human blood was shed for the very first time, vindictively. And ever since, the path of man's history has been strewn with victims of personal vendettas, of national revolutions, of international wars. From the Philippines tonight to Eritrea, from Cambodia to Nicaragua, all over the world, right from that time of Cain slaying Abel. Wars and murder and violence and mayhem have erupted in families, in governments, in nations, decade after decade of world history. And no matter how hard people try to put an end to human conflict, peace seems to elude their grasp. That's a fact of life. Now, why is it? Why has the world been so afflicted with all these wars and these rumors of wars? Well, the Apostle James says, he says, what is the source of quarrels and conflicts among you? Is it not the source of your pleasures that wage war in your members? You want something, but you don't get it, so you commit murder. And you are envious and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. In other words, the root of all this warring is selfishness. There's no question that from the well of selfishness you get personal, national, and international strife. No chapter in all of the Bible shows that clearer than Daniel 11. Here Daniel is given a prophecy that sheds light on the future. And half of it is devoted to things that have already happened, and the other part of it, from verse 36 on, is dealing with what's coming in the future. But certainly, history has been a very clear verification of this vision that Daniel got. Now, this is a chapter about war, and a chapter about rumors of wars. In fact, the first half of this chapter is setting the stage for the worst time of violence that the world will ever know, which is to come in the future at the time of the Great Tribulation, when it will really go across the world. Notice chapter 12 and verse 1. The great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people, 12 and 1, there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation even to that time. And there is a clear prophecy that violence is coming at a future date on this world, the like of which this world has not known yet. And that's a very frightening prophecy. But the stage for that last battle, which I believe to be the Battle of Armageddon, whenever men will for the very last time try to stand up and break the power of God. And I've stood there at Nazareth and looked down the mighty valley of the Megiddo, and there is that great plain where this battle is going to take place. More of that next week. But in this chapter, you have the prelude of history, which is setting the stage for that violence that's coming in the future. And it's set by all this greed-orientated strife that this world is plagued with. Now let's look at it. You have in this chapter at the beginning, from verse 1 to verse number 35, you very clearly have some of the ugly wars of the past, which we're going to concentrate on this evening. Notice that the first ugly war, although it was future to Daniel at his particular time, we know it has taken place, was in verse number 2 of chapter 11. Now I tell you the truth, behold, three more kings shall arise in Persia, and the fourth shall be richer than them all, and by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece. In verse 2, you have the conflicts of the Medo-Persian Empire. The angelic messenger told Daniel that the present king who was over him was going to be succeeded by four more Medo-Persian kings. And then in verse number 2, we are told a fourth of those would be wealthier and mightier than the others, and suddenly he would turn and attack the Grecian Empire. So, of course, this was future to Daniel. We know that that has happened. He shall stir up all against the realm of Greece. Now, that happened, and the fourth was a very powerful monarch called Ahasuerus. And he was richer than the rest, and he invaded Greece 480 years before Christ. And he accumulated great riches as he moved with his army through countries conquesting one after the other. Now, secular history records that he spent 4 years before he attacked Greece gathering an army of 2 million men. And when his vast army passed over the Hellespont, which is between Asia and Europe, it took 7 days and 7 nights for his 2 million men to cross over on bridges of boats, which were led for that purpose. 2 million men, 7 days, 7 nights, solid, going across that point between Asia and Europe. He did indeed, as verse 2 says, stir up all against the realm of Greece. Then you have that amazing character who comes in chapter 11, verse 3. One of the most fascinating men in the history of the world, a man called Alexander of Greece, and known to history as Alexander the Great. Verse 3 says, then a mighty king shall arise, who shall rule with great dominion, and do according to his will. And do according to his will. But notice what verse 4 says. When he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken up and divided towards the four winds of heaven. Now that is a fascinating phrase. When he has arisen. Notice the scripture in its vision of Alexander the Great to Daniel before it happened says he really will just be really getting started. Just really beginning. When it'll be taken away from him. When he has arisen. And you know, when you check into history to find out what happened in history, you know how it perfectly fits in here to this marvelous chapter. In fact, those who are critics of the Bible, it's so accurate, the Bible's prophecy here, that they say, ah, well, it's only fooling. You know, Daniel didn't really have this before it happened. It's only somebody writing after the event. But of course, that can be answered by the fact that there are prophecies that have to do with the future of the world, as we'll see later, that haven't happened yet. So they can't take away from our lovely Word of God with those kind of arguments. But you know, you think of that young man. He was a very handsome young fellow, Alexander the Great. And his tutor was a fellow that I used to study a lot when I was at university, a philosopher called Aristotle. He was his personal tutor, one of the wisest men in all of Greece. And he gave to this young fellow a tremendous love of poetry. And of course, he had terrific courage. And he rose up and he despised luxury and comfort for himself. And his men really loved him. They really counted him a real hero. And when he started to rise in power as a young man, he set his heart, and history tells us this, he set his heart on one great prize. He wanted to defeat the Persian Empire, which was the greatest empire in the world. And you know, when I read that, even in a secular history of this time, I thought of the fact that, yes, and Daniel was right at the center of it all. You know, that Persian Empire. But eventually, of course, along came this man after Daniel's time, set his heart on the Persian Empire. You know the famous story about Alexander the Great, how he was taken into a temple and shown the Gordian knot, which nobody could untie. And they said, the person who unties that will conquer Asia. And of course, he just whipped out his sword and he cut the knot. He was very brave. And away he went into the Persian Empire with his army. And he just won every battle that he had. Darius eventually met him with an army of more than 1 million men, which was even more than Alexander the Great had. But his troops were so well organized and fought so bravely that the huge Persian army was defeated. So he defeated them. And he got his great prize, but of course he didn't stop there. He fought on and he went away to the borders of India. He actually went into India and fought against an Indian prince there. And he was so moved by how the Indian prince behaved and his men fighting so bravely, he gave him back his lands again. Alexander the Great was very famous for being very kind in terms of those kind of men. In comparison to his contemporaries, very kind to the people that he conquered. If you could call it kindness to conquer them, and then sort of be kind to them, but within those terms, he was very kind. And he did that for 7 years, and then he came back into Persia again. And we're told in history, although the detail is not given to Daniel here, that this brilliant young commander who conquered all of the known world, he had another desire in his heart. He wanted the great city of Babylon to be the place where he lived. And you know that we've studied in the book of Daniel how Babylon was set up. He wanted to make it the capital of his new empire. And just as he got into Babylon and into the city of Babylon, before he could carry out his plan, he died at 33 years of age. In the year 323 BC. At 33 years of age, one of the most brilliant young men in history suddenly died. And that is exactly what the Lord had said to Daniel would happen. When he has arisen, he just got up, if you like, whenever he's cut down. And then we move into another period of history. We're told that his kingdom was broken up, but that not among, verse 4, his posterity, nor according to his dominion with which he ruled. His kingdom shall be broken up and divided to the four winds of heaven. In fact, it was given to four of his generals, and Greece was split up. And his little boy, Alexander the Great's little boy, when he was about 7 years of age, was murdered so that he would not inherit his father's empire. And they killed him to get rid of any chance of another of these this Alexander the Great's son or any of his posterity ever being able to take over. So you can see in history that the Bible, of course, exactly agrees with it. When he has arisen, the kingdom shall be broken up, each part given actually to one of his generals. Now, most evangelicals are agreed that when you hit verse 5 to verse number 35, that constitutes a very detailed prophecy concerning two great conflicts. Now, I've put a little map, or a little chart, on the back of your note sheet. And you'll notice that the Ptolemies, they are the kings of the south, that is, Egypt. And the Seleucids, they are the kings of the north, Syria. And from verse number 5 to verse number 35, you have a very detailed history of the toing and froing of the conflicts between these two nations, Syria and Egypt. The amazing thing is, of course, that Syria is still very much involved in this area. And Egypt is also very much involved in this area. And in fact, I can see it certainly in part of this vision, even what's happening there at the moment. Syria's hand, and you've seen it on the news night after night, the general who won't get out of his bunker and won't give up until Syria leave the land and so forth. Well, there it is. You still have that kind of conflict in that northern area, and certainly it's very sensitive in the southern part as well, towards this whole area. So here you have, from verse number 5 to verse number 35, all of these kings. Now, there isn't time tonight to give you all the detail of 5 to 35. If you want to get that in history, you get into a library and get yourself out a good history book and read what happened in all of those kings, Ptolemy 1, Ptolemy 2, and 3, and 4, and 5, and 6, fighting against Seleucus 1, Antiochus 1, Antiochus 2, Seleucus 3, and 3, and Antiochus 3, Seleucus 4, and of course the one that we're particularly interested in tonight that I want to study in a little detail is that very famous one from verse 21 to 32. Of this prophecy, the most wicked of them all, Antiochus Epiphanes, Antiochus the Fourth. So that here you have, in this whole passage of Scripture, a detailed prophecy of the conflicts between Syria and Egypt. The kings in the north, the kings in the south. And the wars, this I think will help you in this detailed passage, the wars between these two raids through Israel. In other words, they're going to fight Egypt. The Syrians come down through Israel. If Egypt's going to fight Syria, the armies come up through Israel. So time after time, as these two nations, to and fro in battles and conflicts, they are always posing a threat to Israel, to Jerusalem, and to the temple of God. The detail of this period would probably cover about 130 years. And not all the details are given to Daniel. You check out in history. It's a fascinating study. And you see how accurate the prophecy is. And of course, you even get that amazing prophecy there in verse 6 and verse 7 about how that one of the queens, one of the families in the south, married into the family of the king of the north, and they tried, you know, he put his wife away and married this this Egyptian, and they thought they could solve the problem through marriage. And then eventually the wife he had put away came back, and if I remember it right, she killed both her husband and the one he had married. And of course, it didn't work, neither of them, you know. But she shall be given up, and those who bought her, with him who begot her, verse 6, and with him who strengthened her in those times. So that even in history, you'll be able to check out the details of what happened in that 130 years. And it exactly fits in with all that happens here. Notice in verse 10, the word is, they shall certainly come and overwhelm and pass through. Notice in verse 22, with the force of a flood, they shall be swept away before him and be broken up. And as Daniel stands over the great river Tigris and is given this vision, and as we'll see next week, the man above the water, the Lord himself, God uses the image of these armies going to and fro as being like a great river that floods its banks and causes mayhem and strife in Israel every time it passes through. Any army on the rampage through any country leaves terrible things behind. But from verse number 21 is something that now begins to arise that I feel is our message for this evening. The fierce Antiochus Epiphanes IV, highlighted from verse 21. And I have no doubt in my heart, the more I study this amazing chapter, that this man foreshadows the Antichrist who follows, and most are agreed on that, the Antichrist following from verse 36. From verse 36, then the king shall do according to his own will. The king who rises up from verse 36 to verse 45 is, of course, the Antichrist, we feel, who is coming in the future. But here this man who comes just before him, from verse 21 to verse number 35, foreshadows him and prefigures him in a whole lot of ways. And we'll tie it up later with the New Testament, and you will see that there's no question that how this Antiochus the Fourth behaved is starting a pattern which will come to an awful height when the great Antichrist rises in the world and gathers his great army to fight against the Lord at the Battle of Armageddon. Now, notice this character, how he behaves from verse number 21. He is very important in Scripture and very important in the book of Daniel. And those of you who've stayed with me through these studies have seen him before. And here he is again in this vision. He's very important. And space and detail are given in the Word of God to him for a particular purpose. His reign extended actually over a period of about 11 years. 175 to 164 BC. Now, how does he behave? Prefiguring the Antichrist, of course, who is coming after him. The strange omen that now comes in the world scene that is very different. Well, notice in verse 21 that he comes, first of all, he's called a vile person, to whom they will not give the honor of royalty. He doesn't look like anybody who could be a king or a great ruler. In fact, he's very nice. In fact, he talks nicely. He's a delightful man. He's lovely to know outwardly. All the kings and queens and politicians who meet him are very impressed with him. Verse 21 says, he shall come peaceably and seize the kingdom by flattery. By sweet talking words, as we say. By intrigue. He doesn't become a king by popular demand. No, no. He becomes a great ruler by flattery. He comes to the throne with a program of peace. That's repeated in verse 24. He shall enter peaceably, even into the richest places of the province. But very early on in his career, he will be shown very clearly to be anything but a man of peace. He comes, actually, according to verse 25, by deceit. Now, what does that teach us? Well, that teaches us that we've got to be very careful whenever great rulers come across the world speaking nice things and speaking peace, peace to everybody, and who are particularly filled with flattery about this nation and that nation and the other nation. Don't be fooled by world leaders who speak with flattering words. Because it's very dangerous if you just base international relations on flattery. But flattery is very powerful, you know. There was a young fellow once, the son of King David, stole the kingdom from David by flattery. He used to stand when all the people would come to see his father on court business and state business. And he used to stand out with his lovely hair and his good looks. And he used to stand there and he used to shake everybody's hand. And he talked lovely smooth words. And all the time he was just sucking them in to blow them out. And to take the nation for himself. He got a whole lot of fellas to run beside him. And he looked like a terrific leader with flattery. See, verse 27 and verse number 28 are intriguing little verses. It shows you what can happen. These kings' hearts shall be bent on evil, and they shall speak lies at the same table, and it shall not prosper, for the end will still be at the appointed time, and while returning to his land with great riches, his heart shall be moved against the holy covenant, so shall he do damage and return to his own land. In other words, what those verses are saying is, kings, politicians, leaders, or whatever you like to call them, who have great power, who change nations, often even lie to each other. Or the in-British word is economical with the truth, which is not a word for lying. Or as Churchill used to call it, sir, the right honourable member is guilty of a terminological inexactitude, which was a nice way for calling him a liar without getting thrown out of the House of Commons. Deceit and lying soon catch up with each other. And of course, ultimately, God has an appointed time when all deceivers and all liars have to face up to him. And they can have deceit and lying for as long as they think they like and talk away, but they'll not go beyond God's time. Notice the wonderful truth that through all of this period of history, and even this which will run away on into the future to the time of the Antichrist and the time of the Battle of Armageddon, that this word occurs in this vision to Daniel about the appointed time. It crops up again and again. You get it in verse 27. You get it in verse 36, for what has been determined shall be done. And you get it in verse 40, at the time of the end. Again and again, this word occurs. It's really saying God has an appointed time, and they will not go beyond it. So that verse 27 and 28 say they'll even lie at the same table to each other. But that'll catch up with them when God's time appointed has come. And of course, they must face the final verdict of Almighty God. So maybe you know somebody who even has a lot of power in your office or in your college or in your line of work or even in your church, who is an inveterate liar. Or she is an inveterate liar. And you say, there's no way that I can get, you know. I was in a shop the other day in Glasgow, and there were a couple of girls were shoplifting. And the lady beside me shouted out, "They're stealing, they're stealing." And those girls went out the door. Well, would you go out after them and say, "Girls, you're stealing, come on back in again"? Do you know, if you did that, you'd be up in court for defamation of character. Wouldn't you? Unless you were a policeman, probably. Or a policewoman. You know, it seems to me at the moment, it's we who are sometimes under lock and key, and the prisoners who are on the street. And they're getting so much money for it, too. It's an amazing turnabout. Peaceful citizens, when they stand up against deceit and lying, then of course, they're really in trouble, aren't they? You saw Count Tolstoy and the famous Lord have a tremendous battle about whether, you know, what the British did in sending those Cossacks back, and so many of them were slaughtered, was actually deceit, or whether it was done truthfully, or did somebody lie, or did they not? And of course, I think Count Tolstoy now has to pay £2 million out because he lost his case and did not prove that Lord Alderidge was lying. In other words, it's a very difficult thing, whatever the truth of whatever side, at any time, to really stand up and find out who is lying and who isn't. And of course, men are innocent until they are proved guilty in this land, we're very glad to be able to say. And we thank God for our laws that stand up for that truth, because it's not the same throughout the nation. But if somebody accuses somebody being a liar, and they're not a liar, I tell you, it can cost a lot of money and ruin their lives. Yet these two go on at this at the same table, but no matter what the courts say or what the people say, or no matter how much they think they are powerful, they will not go beyond God's appointed time. That's a very comforting fact. Then notice in verse number 30, that Antiochus, He decides, you see, he decides to start another campaign against Egypt. Now, it's interesting to read from verse 21 how he begins small, can I just say, verse 23, with a small number of people. He bribes the people. Verse 24, he gives plunder and spoil and riches to those who follow him. And by deceit and bribery and flattery, he gets these people all behind him. Then a very interesting thing happens in verse number 30. He decides to start another campaign against Egypt. And he arrives, we're told in history, within a short distance of the city of Alexandria, called, of course, after young Alexander the Great. And when he arrived in the great city of Alexandria, he met what most commentators believe to be a Roman leader for ships from Cyprus. Now, you'll notice the general translation of that is, putting it all together, is ships from the western land, ships from Cyprus, from that area shall come against him. At the appointed time, verse 29, he shall return and go toward the south, but it shall not be like the former or the latter. Something different happened to this man this time. What happened actually was that the Roman leader stood in front of him and said, "Get out of Egypt." And he stalled for a wee while and he thought he could fool the Romans, but he had known the Romans and he knew of their power and he knew they were the rising power, and he hesitated to pull out of Egypt, but because of Roman power and those soldiers that had come from western lands, he decided that he'd better get out while the going was good, and he, at their insistence, pulled out of Egypt. But as he pulled out of Egypt, he was very annoyed at being humiliated at the hands of the Romans. Notice what verse 30 says. "Therefore he shall be grieved," it was future to Daniel, "and return in rage against the Holy Covenant and do damage. So he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant." Now, this is a very interesting prefiguring of how the Antichrist will behave. Notice on his way back home, he's embittered in his heart that the Romans have stopped him going into Egypt again. So he begins to vent his anger and spleen against the people of God. We take it that that Holy Covenant is the land of Israel. And as he goes back home to Syria, he's so humiliated and so annoyed in his heart and grieved and embittered that he decides to vent this terrible hatred of his against Israel. But the sad, sad feature of this is, so says verse 30, he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. In other words, when he came back up with his mighty army going home, and he is going to put pressure upon the city of Jerusalem and the way the people of God worship, some of the people of God, to put it in plain teenage language, chicken out, and they join him, and they betray the Lord. Notice that. Notice how he operates. He flatters, bribes, helps, gives things to those who forsake the Holy Covenant. They took sides with the enemy. And you know, you can see features of that even today, can't you? Whenever great powers arise and it becomes embarrassing to be a believer, but work, or in academic circles, or political circles, or whatever, there are many Christians who give in. And they join the enemy and deny their Lord. And it's very hard to stand against flattery. And it's awful hard to stand against bribery. It's very hard to stand against deceit. And what did he do? They joined him. And he turned round, and for the first king in all of the book of Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar, none of the rest of them ever did this. He stopped the daily sacrifice in the temple. He stopped the people of God reading their scriptures. He stopped women circumcising their little Jewish children, boys. And if he found that they had done so, he took the children, the boys and their mothers, and they were pushed out over cliffs and their brains dashed against the stones at the bottom. And those who opposed him, verse number 33, those of the people who understand shall instruct many. Yet for many days they shall fall by sword and flame, by captivity and plundering. Now when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join with them by intrigue. Isn't that incredible? Those poor people now have to stand up against him, and when they do stand up against him, they are killed, they are burnt, they are despised. That has real shades of what it means to be a Christian today, doesn't it? And how it's going to be increasingly difficult for you to stand up for your Lord and for the truth of God in all that's happening around you. But you know, there's something very interesting in this section that always fires my heart when I think about it. In each of those three sections of history that you have read, of the north, the south, the north, and the various kings that go through those three major periods, those armies pouring through and threatening Israel and Jerusalem and the temple of God, every time they come, it seems to be the end. But it isn't. It isn't. Notice in verse 27, the two kings lying, it says, but it shall not prosper, for the end will still be at the appointed time. In other words, it's not time yet for the end. It hasn't come yet. Notice verse 35, some of them understanding shall fall to refine them, purge them, make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time. It looked when they were being killed and burnt and pillaged and their worship wrecked, they all said, this is it. This is the end time. The Messiah will now come and he will get us out of this situation. There's no question that this is the end. And they're all saying that to each other in their hearts and with their lips. But in fact, it was not so. It's not until you come to verse 40 that you read about the end. At the time of the end. That's that last great time. The end. When all man's rebellion will be headed up in that mighty battle that is coming. I'm telling you, the wonderful truth is that the Christ will win and will defeat them. No question about that. And I've given you the passages in Revelation and here, notice 3b in your notes, and you go home and study those and think about them when you're at home. And you can look up those verses. Don't do it now because that's future to us, but read them in the week that's coming. And you'll see the link up between the two passages. But will you please notice the importance of the fact that although each time it seems to be the end, it isn't the end. And of course, there's a very practical lesson in that. You watch Gorbachev change the face of Europe in a month or two. And he talks very smoothly. And now, for the first time in all of the time of the Soviet Union, he goes to see the Pope, and the pair of them seem to get on so well, and he seems to be now sort of putting his hand out to those who are religious. He's now saying, we're going to give religious freedom to everybody. And he talks smoothly, and he comes into Italy, and the crowds turn out and shout, Gorby, 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 Gorby. He goes into Czechoslovakia, and they shout, Gorby, 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 Gorby. He goes into East Germany and they say, Honecker, 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 out. And Garby, 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 Garby. And he kisses him and it's the kiss of death. Within a week he's out and tonight he's under house arrest. And you look at that and you say, oh God, what's happening here? Is NATO going to do a flip here? Are they all going to sit around their tables and say, Garby, 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 Garby? Is President Bush and Margaret Thatcher, and are they all going to say, Garby, 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 Garby? You say, you speak in jest. No, I don't. I see how quickly it comes, how fast it comes, how subtle it is, what a link there is between professed religion and politics and power and flattery and money. And opening up nations so businessmen are absolutely jumping to get into these countries to sell whatever. Candy bars to you name it. Millions to be made. Is Europe going to become one vast centralized economic thing? And then Mrs. Thatcher, she stands up and says, no, I don't want to go into Europe that far. We don't want to lose sovereignty. And tonight she faces a vote on that very issue, and every one of her MEPs, it seems, have sent a voice and saying, we don't like the way she's speaking against this centralization of the economy in Europe and so forth. You know, it's fascinating, isn't it? And you say, could he be the Antichrist? Gorbachev? Is this it? Is this him coming up now, and is he going to fool Europe and then suddenly show his teeth within 7 years or whatever? And people say this and that, you know. Well, when I was a young fella, I was preaching in Korea. And I remember it. I went in there to preach amongst those Korean Christians, and Japanese Christians were coming across to teach those Korean churches. And there was a fella at the height then when I was in Korea called Henry Kissinger. And everybody was going, Henry, 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 Henry. And nations were going, Henry, 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 Henry. And Henry seemed to have all the answers. You know, I tried to listen to that man. I don't think I've ever understood a paragraph he ever spoke. Not because of his accent, but because of the very deep syntax he has in his expressions. I find him awfully hard to understand. I'm sure he'd find me even worse, but... You know, fascinating man as he speaks about world affairs. And the Japanese Christians were coming to the Korean Christians and they were saying, look, look, I'll tell you, the Antichrist is Kissinger. But the time wasn't the end, was it? And of course, you go back into the war and Hitler came and he had a representative in all the German churches, or most of them, on their boards. And he had a link up with religion and so forth. And he was mighty, and people were saying, well, the Lord will be here any time. He'll be here any time. It's bound to be the end. He's just invaded Poland, and Czechoslovakia has fallen, and France has fallen. This is it. Adolf is the Antichrist. This is the end. And 20 million people died. But it wasn't the end. So as you look out over world history, and as you look out over what's happening to you, remember the importance of Daniel 11. Daniel 11 is saying again and again and again, when the king of the north, and remember of course that Russia's hand is very closely tied up with Syria, and it's Russian power behind Syria, and so on and so forth. You know, when you see all of that, just be cautious, be careful in jumping to conclusions. We shall see next week in particular, as we look into chapter 12, some of the features that will definitely be identifiable at the end time, that will make it different to all those other north-south conflicts that have come all the way through, even to Jimmy Carter's day with Sadat at Camp David and so on, that has raged right through all of these years, which I think is all covered in this north and south conflict again and again, and Israel being at the center of it. The practical lesson is, be cautious when you are reading the times. And in all of these times, you might have thought, this definitely is the end, and then it can fizzle out, And you got to be careful. Don't be going around and saying, well, definitely sure this is it, and preaching this is it. And then, of course, you could find that it isn't it, and that the person you think is the Antichrist isn't. And then unconverted people are disillusioned with all of your talk. They say, there you are, you see, that's what they said, and it wasn't so. Stick to the balance of Scripture. The real vision for the time of the end was not yet. Until, verse 35, until the end, the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time. Even though Antiochus wrecked and ruined the people of God, desecrated the temple, sacrificed a pig on the altar, which was abhorrent to the Jews, and really did despite to the spirit of grace, it wasn't the end. So there's a balance there. And I was very interested to hear Nancy Reagan say on television last night that she didn't get on with Ryazan Gorbachev because of a debate they had over religion. Oh, I'd love to talk to her for an hour, wouldn't you? What happened? Well, of course, as far as I know, Ryazan is an atheist. And it's an atheistic state. Very interesting what's going on, but don't jump to conclusions too quick. But the trends are all there. And as it may not be the end yet, of course, and so on and so forth, but the fact is, we know it's coming. You say, okay, Derek, we've got all of this teaching about the north and the south and wars and rumors of wars and the coming wars of the future and so on. What am I supposed to be doing in Belfast at the moment? I mean, I'm a believer and I'm waiting for the Lord to come to take me to be with Himself and to go to reign with Him and so on and see all of His great victories, to be with Him in those. What am I supposed to be doing in the middle of all this? Well, you see, there is that priceless little verse, 32. Those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt by flattery. But the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. You haven't to sit back and say, well, these things are coming. And this great conflict is coming. So there's nothing I can do. No, no. Even when the northern king was fighting the southern king, and the southern king was fighting the northern king, and they were going to and fro and threatening the people of God in Israel, there were people amongst the people of God who stood up in those times, and they did great things for God. They that do know their God shall do great exploits. I wonder tonight, if there's somebody listening to me who's filled with envy. You're filled with envy against somebody who is doing well. I have a little poem that I'm kind of fond of. It says, I hate the guys who minimize and criticize the other guys whose enterprise has made them rise above the guys who criticize and minimize. Once again, I hate the guys who minimize and criticize the other guys whose enterprise has made them rise above the guys who criticize. I want to say to you tonight, Christian, if you are eaten up with envy or whatever, stop eating your heart out because somebody's a step or two ahead of you in the race and gaining momentum. Relax, Christian. You are you, not them. And you are responsible, and I am responsible to do the very best that I or you can with what we've got for as long as we are able. And by God's grace, you, Christian, can, in the midst of all of this turmoil in Europe, do great exploits. If Gorbachev has opened this door to the Soviet Union, I want to be first in to preach the word if I could get half a chance. Wouldn't you? Or wouldn't you be wanting to get Bibles to them? In Geneva the other day, there's a lady there, a Christian. I was talking to her, and she owns a hotel, and she cannot keep up giving Bibles to the Russians who are pouring into her hotel. These are fantastic days with all that's going on. Even if there is deceit and flattery and lies and all kinds of skullduggery, it's up to us in the middle of it, as God overrules the whole situation, to do great exploits for the Lord. Don't be sitting back and saying there's nothing I can do. I like to compare it this way. If you'll forgive the analogy. I like to compare parrots with eagles. You know, we go to Ayr as a family a lot on holiday. There's a church I preach in there quite a lot, and we go there on holiday too, and we're very close to a church there and people there, and we've ministered there a lot over these years. And you know, there's a pet shop in Ayr. And my girls, every time they go to Ayr, "Oh, Dad, can we go and see the parrot?" "A more mangy, miserable thing you never saw. But they gotta go and see the parrot." Twins especially. "Oh, let's go and see the parrot, Dad." And you know, they go in, and there's, with due respects to her if she sees this, the lady who looks after the parrot isn't the friendliest woman in the world. Had little children who come in to see her parrot and don't buy seed or whatever. And I can see those two girls yet, holiday after holiday, into the same shop, sneaking in to try and find if the old parrot's still there. And they go up, and they kind of whisper to it, "Hello, hello." And they try to get it to talk back to them. I mean, it's absolutely incredible. I forget what the stupid thing says, but it has some kind of phrase that it uses. I think it wolf whistles, actually. And boy, they love that when they can get the old thing to off its perch and say whatever it says. And I kind of stand in the back and pray they won't get thrown out in their ear, or that I won't have to, if the parrot is broken, I'll have to pay for that which is broken and bring it home. You know, if you've got a parrot, the Lord bless you, Long John Silver. But I want to tell you that parrots have very soft bellies and big beaks and little heads. They have. And parrots, as far as I know, are not keen-eyed and wide-winged creatures willing to soar into the illimitable ranges of God's creation, like eagles are. Parrot people are much different to eagle people. You notice that parrots love to stay in their cage and pick over their little pan full of seeds. And they love to hear the same words over and over again until they can say them with ease. They love company. They love attention, even the twins' attention. And they scratch. If you scratch them here and snuggle them there, they'll stay there for years on the same perch. Can you remember the last time you saw a parrot fly? I mean, I've been to Disneyland with my friend Val English. The things preachers get up to. And I remember sitting there, and I remember so well, they brought out these parrots. And those parrots, you know, there was even one on roller skates. It was incredible. But none of them flew. Parrots like to be predictable. They like to get stroked. They like a mutual admiration society. They're not like eagles. Eagles are very intelligent. They love to think. Eagles are driven with an urge to search, to discover, to learn. Eagles are amongst the most courageous birds on the face of the earth. They can dive at 200 miles an hour, which is even faster than a Porsche on the M2 would be allowed to do. And eagle people are like that. They like the deep things of God. See an eagle coming fresh from the thin air of the Himalayas with thoughts, if you like, in my analogy, that are clear. Eagles take risks to get their food because they hate things that come from little small dishes of picked over seeds that are boring and repetitious and dull and dry. Eagles have never been, eagle people have never been completely extinct in the Christian church. You can pick them out in history, can't you? And I could go through a whole list of them. Christians who dared to go deeper. Believers who weren't satisfied with dull, repetitious little phrases they heard somebody else say that they picked up and that they regurgitate out until everybody's bored out of their minds. No, no. Original thinkers in the 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th centuries. But could you name me many of them today who are different and unpredictable and fresh and original and into the deep things of God? Can you? It seems to me that they are increasingly rare in the Christian church. Why? Because the philosophy of the vast majority in the Christian church, if you'll forgive me saying it, I feel it in my heart in general, have a philosophy that says, "Preacher, entertain me. Please, I've had a long day." Rather than those who plead, "Preacher, make me think. Draw me after God. Show me Christ." Have you ever looked at those wonderful words in 2 Timothy 3? And they are pretty powerful, aren't they? 2 Timothy 3. But this, know this, verse 1. That in the last days, perilous times will come. 3:1, 2 Timothy. For men will be lovers of themselves. You think that's today? Lovers of money. You think that's today? Boasters. Pride. Blasphemers. Disobedient to parents. Unthankful. Unholy. Unloving. Unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God, having a form of godliness, but denying its power. Oh yes, they have an outward talk of Christians, but there's no power, there's no feeling of power, or any sight of power, or result of power that you could feel or see or know. It's just a form of godliness that's rotten and selfish. No power in it. From such people, turn away. Hope you don't spend your time with that bunch. For of this sort are those who creep into households and make captives of gullible women, loaded down with sins and led about by away by various lusts, always learning and never coming to the knowledge of the truth. And they come into churches and with their sweet talking, they lead away gullible women from house to house and wreck the testimony, says Paul. Last day living. Are you a parrot? Or are you an eagle? Notice chapter 4, verse 3. The time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine. But according to their own desires, because they have itching ears, they will heap up for themselves teachers, and they will turn their ears away from the truth and be turned aside to fables. They'd rather listen to a fella talking fables in the pulpit than telling them the truth. But you be what? How should you live then, Christian, with all this bunch around you? Well, you should be watchful in all things, says this translation. Do you know that when searching for food, an eagle can soar to a height of 2,400 feet and from that vantage point can survey an area of 4.5 square miles? Do you know that an eagle's vision is so exceptionally sharp because each eye has 2 fovea, that's areas of acute vision, the human eye has only 1, that an eagle can actually spot a rabbit at 2 miles distant? I was flying out of Glasgow this week and they were telling us, they say, we can't take off the legal limits 1.5 miles. If it's foggy, beyond that we're in trouble. Or lesser than that, we're in trouble. Do you know that an eagle has peripheral vision? An eagle's eye can turn 270 degrees. Do you know that an eagle can even see with its eyes shut? Because it has got inner eyelids called nictitating membranes that can close over. They can, you know, it's transparent, but those can close over their eyes so that whenever their hungry eaglets are coming, they don't hurt their eye. They've got protection over their eyes. Do you know that because you know the Lord, Christian, you can see like nobody else can? You got this book here, and Daniel 11, as you read the newspaper and watch the newscasts. You can see things that fellow working on that computer beside you can't see. That teacher teaching beside you doesn't know because she's tied up in glossy magazines and thinks that life is all just, you know. What you wear and how you look. I watch a whole lot of fellas going around at the moment in these, what do I call them, clothes? And they are prisoners of fashion. They look ridiculous. But they think they're boss or something. Ridiculous. If they'd only buy clothes that suit them. That suit them. But they don't. You say, you're one to be talking, look at you. Yeah, it's true. I know I'm like an unmade bed, but there it is. What I'm trying to say is, Christian, are you a parrot sitting on your perch? When with all that the Holy Spirit has given you and the insights He has given you in the Word of God, you should be able to see things and know things and be soaring into great exploits in your church, in your local area, in your city, in your nation. Ah, he says, be watchful in all things. Be like an eagle, you know, Timothy. Eagle's eyes are to the fore, you know. We can only see eyes in front, but they got this beak and these 2 eyes set in the forehead. They can see a lot. And the Word of God says, if you wait upon the Lord, you'll renew your strength and you will soar. You will go up on wings like an eagle. You'll be able to see. Notice he says, now Timothy, endure afflictions. You endure them. You think this fella Daniel didn't endure afflictions? I tell you. Do you know that an eagle, because of the way its primary feathers are, actually enjoys being in a wind of a hurricane 4 scale? And that all it has to do is just move its feathers just a little, and it's like something nailed to the sky. You put a parrot up in front of Hugo, that Ivor and Hillary here beat home from Florida. You put the old parrot up from air and say, come on, son. Come on. Let's let you out with your stomach filled with those dried seeds and we'll take you up in a 747. We'll drop you into a hurricane and see. You say, you're being... The Royal Society for the Protection of Birds will be after you, Derek. Well, yes, they might. But, you know, you put the old softened parrot into a hurricane 4 scale, blow it away. But an eagle... It flies better in turbulence. As with the eagle, says Moses, so with the Lord. And when the winds come against you and they flow in your window, Daniel the eagle, the winds of death saying, you pray, we'll kill you. He soars into it, into a den of lions, and out again, mighty, doing great exploits for God. Because he's got the equipment to do it. God's power. They that do... Am I getting excited? They that do know their God shall do great exploits. You know the Lord. Well, I'm not saying this literally, but what are you doing then stuck on that perch? And fiddling about and they're saying, say this after me. And you say, all right. Instead of getting into the word yourself and digging for it. And finally, endure hardness and fulfill your ministry. Isn't that lovely? Fulfill your ministry. You got a work to do like Timothy had. Yours mightn't be the same as his. He was an evangelist. But are you fulfilling it? Or have you joined the parrots and you're stuck in the pet shop? Instead of soaring into your ministry for God. Like, I know the time's gone and you've been very patient, but it was the 7th of April, 1865. It was 11 o'clock in the morning, and President Lincoln was battle-weary, and he lifted a wee bit of paper, and he wrote these words on it. It read, General Sheridan says, if the thing is pressed, I think that Lee will surrender. Let the thing be pressed. Abraham Lincoln. And Grant got the message, and he attacked Lee, and at the Appomattox courthouse, 2 days later, Robert E. Lee surrendered, and the great slaughter of the Civil War stopped. I love that wee line. 3 lines! Sheridan says, if the thing is pressed, I think Lee'll surrender. Let that thing be pressed. He fulfilled his ministry. Did Lincoln? No greater U.S. president than Lincoln, you know, with a very deep faith. And I can tell you something, friend, he was no parrot. There are few men whose dying beds I have queued to see. But unashamedly, I queued to see Lincoln's deathbed with a very blood stain still, that little stain on the pillow when he was shot by that terrible man Booth at Ford's Theatre and taken across the road and led in the man's house where he died. I have never queued to see a dead parrot's dying bed, and there are millions of them. Oh, what do you want to be? Why do they call him Eddie the Eagle? Because he's a terrific skier? No, sir, he ain't. Why do they go mad by the million and all these sleek guys look terrific and marvelous and wonderful and soar to great heights? And here comes this plasterer from England shuffling down, and your sweat breaks on you, and you're praying, Lord, get him out over the edge and bring him home. Why did my wee girl stop him in London and say, Eddie, would you give me your autograph? Why? Ah, because the other slick parrots are all right. They're one of a kind. But Eddie's a national hero. You remember the 84 Olympics? You remember the lady who staggered into the stadium and she focused on the tape and she stumbled and fell and the world said, go on, get up! And the race was over and everybody was seemingly virtually gone home. Why did that lady catch everybody's heart? as she fell just before the tape and then got up and kind of fell over it. You'd have thought she was the nation's mother. Why? Because she finished. That's why. Everybody wanted her to finish what you set out to do. Now, I have a feeling there's somebody in here tonight. And you started to do something for God. And you soared for years. But you've joined the old parrots. You don't soar anymore. It's lonely being an eagle. Not many, many up there in that rarefied air as you search for deeper things. Plan to begin what you've, to finish what you started out to begin. Has God sent me to this pulpit tonight to encourage some of you not to quit, but to keep going for the Lord? Please. Can I say this? I have a thing I want to begin. And I hope God gives me the grace to finish it with you in the next couple of months. God's been speaking to me over these past weeks, and I can't get away from it, about the power of that little instrument behind your teeth. It sits in a slippy place, and it's liable to slip. In a wet place, your tongue. And I want to start on the 9th of January a series with you on the tongue. I want to look at lying. I want to look at swearing. I want to look at gossip. I want to look at flattery. I want to look at praise. I want to look at encouragement. I want to look at communication between teenagers and their parents, between husband and wife, which seems often to have broken down in many areas. I want to look at the whole area for about 8 weeks or so. The power of the tongue. And I want to set out by God's grace to teach you something so that hundreds of you, maybe even thousands of you, will go out into this community and cut out all this wastage of words and start really communicating health and goodness and grace and kindness and blessing. That your tongue be transformed by the power of God. I don't want to talk to you for 8 weeks about the tongue's movement. I want to talk to you about the movement of the tongue. And I hope we'll be able to finish what we began. Well, where do you want to soar in the next few weeks? What do you want to do? You'll not find a parrot feather in the book of Daniel. So what do you want to be? Do you want to stay put? Or are you an eagle at heart? To soar and explore. You look ridiculous in that cage if you're in it, friend. If you're an eagle at heart. You look awful silly if you're stuck on a perch going over those dried seeds. They that do know their God shall do great exploits. Let's hope this new year be the best we've ever seen. And thanks for listening for so long.